City of Angels, Premier Radio Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
We're going to talk about the Book of Revelation in a moment and also Hopi prophecy. Just notice that NBC is going to be doing a series on they call it Revelations. And it seems like this whole planet is becoming more and more aware of things like that. We'll be back in a moment with our guest Daniel Pinchback on Coast to Coast AM. Daniel, there seems to be an incredible fascination with the Book of Revelation. You've looked at this as well. Does this tie in also to Mayan and Hopi prophecy?
Yeah, I mean, I think it all works pretty amazingly, you know, synchronistically together. I mean, the concept of moving into a new Jerusalem, I would say, would be the same as the Hopi fifth world. I mean, they believe we're in the fourth world and transitioning to the fifth world. And the same as the, you know, sort of Mayan shift in 2012 into a kind of enlightened, compassionate state for humanity.
You know, some people have interpreted the Book of Revelation as being not all that bad for mankind. And I keep going back and reading it, and it doesn't look like a good period for us. What's your take?
Right. Well, I mean, literally the apocalypse means uncovering or revealing. Which means that basically everything gets kind of, you know, upsurged and vomited forth so for everyone to see. And I think that we can see that that is, to a certain extent, happening right now, and that things are becoming very, very transparent and obvious. And really, there's you know, there's no place to hide and no place to run. I mean, I personally think that, you know, the World Trade Tower is falling very much seems to be something that was prophesied in Revelation 11.
And Nostradamus probably as well.
Right. I actually can never deal with Nostradamus somehow. You know, you have to go with the prophecy stuff that you vibe with, and I just can't vibe with Nostradamus.
Okay. All right. That's fair enough.
So I think we're in this period which culminates in this transformation of consciousness. And definitely it looks like it's going to get, you know, rough. I mean, that's also, according to this guy, Carl Johan Kalman's reading of the Mayan calendar, there are these sort of cycles at various scales that get sort of smaller and smaller as we approach this date. And in each of these smaller cycles, there's a kind of alternation of dark and light energy currents. And he places the sort of dark energy current around 2008, 2009, and suggests that we might go through a kind of global financial collapse at that point. And, I mean, personally, I almost think that's something to hope for as the kind of predatory and parasitic nature of the economy and the technosphere are damaging the biosphere at a really quick rate. So we would sort of hope for something to slow that down, which would also give us the time to kind of recuperate and to constellate a kind of new vision for what planetary culture could be. And I think, you know, that I mean, for me, one interesting tool for that would be to think about time and the clock. And if we think about the Gregorian calendar, this was José Arguelles' point, is completely desynchronized. I mean, originally back, before Mesopotamia, people followed a lunar calendar,
right,
which was precisely oriented to lunar cycles. And those, they were also sort of under the Great Mother. I mean, the moon represents the sort of feminine. So they worshipped the Great Mother, and they precisely followed a lunar calendar. When the sort of civilizations of Mesopotamia came up, they switched to a patriarchal dominator mindset and the kind of solar calendar, where they divided the circle into 360 degrees and tried to create 12 perfect months, which didn't work. So they ended up making calendars that were no longer synchronized to natural cycles. And Arguelles' point is that the calendar is a kind of metaprogramming device for the human mind that entrains us to a certain way of being in reality. So if we're following a desynchronized calendar, although we don't realize it, it sort of drives us all subtly insane and progressively desynchronizes us from experience of natural time. So he proposed a calendar, the 13 moon calendar, which I think is very interesting and has validity and is kind of based on the Mayan system.
Okay.
But I think ultimately we're going to have to create a new calendar that would, I mean, it's not a project for one person. It would require a kind of global meeting of minds, like technicians.
Everything would have to change. Everything.
Well, the great thing about the new calendar is that if we instituted it and we made it a global standard, completely synchronized to natural cycles, really carefully worked out,
right,
bringing in Islamic traditions, indigenous, Judeo-Christian, astronomers, once that new time was instituted, we could make it retroactive as well as projective. So all of the kind of agglomeration of nation-state charters, of corporate debt structures, third-world debt structures, all of that stuff could be just eliminated at one fell swoop.
They're going to have to
start again with a new harmonic paradigm.
I tell you what, they're going to have to eliminate our debt structure too. You know, ours is going to be worse off than all the others combined, the way we're going.
Right. Well, I mean, it may reach the point where this whole idea of this kind of abstract value imposed on reality just becomes untenable. And, we know at the moment, I think 200 billionaires control more wealth than like 3/4
yes,
of the planet's population. So, I mean, this is clearly an insane situation.
Would we be talking about a 13-month calendar? Would that...
Unfortunately, the 13-moon calendar doesn't quite work because the moon doesn't actually circle the sun precisely 13 times
right,
a year. There's a full moon cycle, which is like 29.6 or something, and there's another one which is like 28.2, which is past a fixed star. So it really is a technical, kind of both a spiritual and a technical problem.
Would we have to change the entire 12-month structure then?
Sure. Yeah. We would go into a new time. And doing that, we would delegitimize all of the malfunctioning institutions that have operated. It would really be like the seal on this new consciousness transformation. It would give us a new basis from which to begin.
Maybe we can change our age. Maybe I can drop down to 30 or something. Huh?
Whatever you want to be.
But you are right. It would take an effort, I think, of everyone to be involved in something. That indeed is a planetary decision, isn't it?
Yeah. And also, I mean, looking at this kind of archetype, these different archetypes like the apocalypse, I mean, Glastonbury has a huge number of myths around it, and there's one which is about, you know, the 12 tribes of Glastonbury combining to sort of weave a 13th tribe and install a New Jerusalem. I mean, there's this whole 12-13 thing which plays through a lot of fairy tales and folk tales and myths, including King Arthur and the 12 knights, or Christ and the 12 disciples.
Yes, you're right.
It's in Sleeping Beauty, the 13th wise woman who's not invited, who then curses the kingdom. So this is somehow a basic underlying structure, and it seems to be really referring specifically to this calendar problem. And Glastonbury seems like a place, especially since all the stone circles are kind of around there, where it could be a kind of global meeting to come up with a new concordance. This is an idea that I'm putting forth in my book anyway as a kind of solution.
Would it be easy or difficult to change, assuming you had cooperation?
I think it would be easy. I think it would be. I mean, people would really have to understand that the time we're now is, desynchronized. And then they would feel the kind of natural need for change. And if you think about, you know, how we live in time, I mean, this is a whole other aspect of my book. You know, we've constructed a kind of linear, spatialized time. And the way we think about time is we talk about time as an amount. You know, you have enough time, you're wasting time, you're spending time, you're running out of time. And that's our conventional conception of time. But actually, time is not like that at all. It underlies space. It's different than space.
Tell me a little bit about the Hopis and their prophecy. Of course, some of it is kind of startling, quite frankly. But who were the Hopi tribe?
Well, who are the Hopi tribe? There, you can still go visit them. Yeah. I went and visited them last summer. I mean, they're out in New Mexico.
How many of you have members?
It's about 12,000.
12,000, okay.
They live on these mesas in this incredible desert landscape, which really looks like the surface of Mars or something. And they are subsistence farmers. I mean, they have certain crops which they grow in this land, which is a pretty remarkable feat. And, I mean, they are considered to be the original dwellers on the American continent. Chaco Canyon is an incredible sort of sculpted canyon that is a bit like Stonehenge and Avebury, that it sort of uses the sun and the moon, follows their tracks in various ways. So they have a very sophisticated ritual, spiritual culture with different sort of secretive clans, and they feel very exploited and kind of maltreated by modern society. I mean, they're, you know, from what I understand, their original way of being is completely non-hierarchical and to a certain extent telepathic. And even anthropologists who studied them, like Cambridge anthropologists who studied them in recent years, feel that they've retained this kind of telepathic level. I mean, this anthropologist would go, he would get his questions together, and he would go to visit one of the elders, and the elder would start answering all of the questions before he could formulate them. And I, you know, it's definitely a very sacred and amazing landscape. And so they have this emergence myth, which is basically there have been three previous worlds. We're now in the fourth world. They have a set of oral prophecies about how the fourth world will end. Almost all of these prophecies have now been fulfilled.
Now, what's the definition of a world?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and I don't have a complete answer for you. Whether that means a form of consciousness, whether that means an actual incarnation of the Earth,
or an end of a particular civilization or era,
or an end of a cycle,
or a cycle for something. Like maybe, for example, when the asteroid hit 65 million years ago, wiped out the dinosaurs. Maybe that was the end of a world. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I've also been looking a lot at the ideas of Rudolf Steiner, who was this Austrian visionary philosopher in the 19th century. And he also, although I don't think he even knew about the Hopis, he said there have been three previous worlds. We were currently in the fourth world, moving towards transition to the fifth world. And he ascribed names to these worlds based on sort of planets. Like he called the next incarnation was going to be the Jupiter incarnation. And he described very specifically, or in kind of esoteric terms, like some of the changes that were going to take place. Like he said that the organ of generation, you know, procreation, was going to move from the sex organ to the throat chakra. So that we'd actually be kind of communicating or singing beings like ourselves into existence.
That's fascinating.
I mean, he had a whole series of ideas like that, which begin to make more and more sense to me the more I sit with them. And especially if you think about ayahuasca or DMT, where you see this kind of visual language, you know, as Terrence McKenna also kind of went into. I don't know, it seems to me there's something there.
In the emergence to the fifth world, if I've studied a Hopi prophecy correctly, they say some pretty startling things about this planet, right?
In what sense?
Well, no. do they talk about the possibility of a third world war?
Yeah, they say that there's going to be, we may already be in this war. They say a war fought with material means over spiritual matters. That will end in the destruction of the United States land and peoples.
By atomic bombs, they say, don't they?
Well, yeah, I mean, but there, you know, there you're sort of like looking at,
Or is that interpretation?
Well, it's not interpretation, but prophecy is also, you know, something that evolves over time. I don't think there are prophecies from thousands of years ago talked about radiation and atomic bombs. I mean, apparently they did have this prophecy about a gourd of ashes falling on a city.
Yes.
They thought was realized by Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But again, I think it's a little more complicated in that sort of the prophecy is for them part of the, I mean, anyone who speaks in their tribe has access to the prophecy and can kind of shape it. I mean, they have the basic format of the myth, but then it sort of evolves over time. But I mean, I think that the basic outline, you know, which coheres so well to the Aztec idea of the fifth sun and all these other ideas, seems to be very fundamentally sound.
They believe, though, that this this destruction will occur sooner than later.
Right. See, once again, I mean, you're stressing the destruction.
Right.
And I try not to stress that, because I think that that is like just a trip, you know, sort of, it's sort of like a mind trip that we like to go on.
Well, yeah, but Daniel, you can't ignore it. I mean,
no, of course you can't. But I mean, for me, when I went down there, I mean, I had this interest in understanding their prophecies, and I did finally get the oral transmission of the prophecy from one of their elders. But what I began to realize when I read about them was about this Peabody coal mining company, which has this concession on their land, which is siphoning out 1 billion gallons of water a year from their aquifer.
I know the company well. They're based in Illinois.
That's right, the pipeline built by Enron. And I realized that, you know, we're focusing our energy on the wrong place. We're worried about the destruction. If we could stop the pipeline and make a great relationship with the Hopi and become the Pahana, the elder white brother they've been waiting for, then I think we wouldn't have to spend all of our time neurotically focused on destruction. We could actually begin to move towards creation and construction, which is where we need to go really, really quickly.
Or are you saying that the prophecy are things that will be or could be?
Well, I'm saying that mind is the basis of reality. So it's really where you want to put your stress, you know. And I put my stress on the positive, creative possibilities. And I think that there's still time to work with them and to, you know, mitigate the bad stuff and to actually make a proper relationship. And I think it's clear that we have as much to learn from these indigenous cultures. You know, well, I mean, who knows what they have to learn from us, but we definitely have a lot to learn from them about how to work with the earth, which is what they said, you know, they were sort of protecting, the knowledge they were protecting, and also about how to create a non-hierarchical society based on telepathic communion rather than hierarchical dominance.
Well, but when they say that the United States will be destroyed, are they saying, am I interpreting this as being a physical destruction, or is it more of a destruction of ideology, and maybe that's going to change?
Well, there you go. Now you've moved into a more positive framework on thinking about these things. You know, it's really a question of the kind of, since, as I said, from my perspective, we're creating reality. You know, we're articulating it. We're drawing it into existence. So let's draw positive reality into existence rather than constantly being focused on negativity. So, yeah, maybe it's destruction of ideology. Maybe, you know, radiation is food irradiation, and it's already affected those people it's going to affect who've been eating, you know, huge amounts of cow for the last 15 years.
Well, you know, you see things like farmers in Europe opposed to taking genetically modified seed. They don't want to use it. And I see that as possibility, as a trend. It's not happening in this country, unfortunately. But, I mean, they're trying to stand pat.
Yeah.
That could be part of the prophecies, too.
Which could be the
you know, trying to avoid taking like genetically
totally
modified foods and things.
I mean, basically, what's going to come to pass is going to come to pass, and but you know, we have the time and the possibility to focus our energy in more or less positive ways. And you know, what I would like to see in the future is actually, you know, I think that our Western consciousnesses have evolved enough. I mean, the '60s, we sort of went there as hippies, and they ended up having to pass like anti-hippie ordinances, you know, where we can actually go to the tribe like the Hopi and try to really create a true partnership, recognizing that there are aspects of the soul, aspects of the earth that they understand that we need to learn from at this point in time. And then maybe they would be interested in some of our, you know, more sophisticated kind of symbiotic technologies, where we're actually trying to work with nature rather than just work against nature.
The Hopi, when they came up with these prophecies, again, with this through their own shamans?
Yeah, I think that the prophecy, and my understanding of it is that, you know, it's really based on attunement to reality as it is. And the deeper that you're attuned to reality as it is, the more you're already in a prophetic mind state.
That's fascinating. Well, stay with us. I'm going to open up Fast Blast now to give you an opportunity to ask us a question. I'll pass that right on to Daniel Pinchback. And then at the top of the hour, we'll just simply open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to chat with him, too. There's lots more to talk about here. I want to get in next, of course, into the thoughts of some of these psychedelics. We touched on them in the beginning. You know, the possibility. Should they be legalized? Should they not? Are they? Some of them. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
The official website of Coast to Coast AM is www.coasttocoastam.com. Log on now. Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
On our next Coast to Coast program, first hour, our guest will be Richard C. Hoagland. He's going to update us about some things going on near Mars and Saturn. And then our main guest will be Dr. David Humes. We're going to talk with him about mysticism and intuition. That'll be on our next Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back with our guest, Daniel Pinchback, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Daniel, let's talk a little bit, and then we're going to go to some Fast Blast questions here for you. Of these psychedelics, again, we only touched on it an hour ago. The ayahuasca, that there are some people who have used it. I think David Icke told me he's tried it before, and a number of other people as a psychedelic. What does this do to people when they take it?
Well, I mean, what does it do to you? It sort of relaxes you, and then it sort of introduces you into a kind of visionary reality. It's a little bit kind of a waking dream vision. I mean, my recent experiences of it was I went down to Brazil and worked with a religion based in the Amazon called the Santo Daime, which weaves together indigenous and Christian elements. And they use it pretty differently than tribal societies do, where you sort of lie in a hammock and the shaman will sing through the night and you'll see visions. Their ceremonies are larger. They're under these kind of bright fluorescent lights, and you all sing together or dance together. And they kind of use it as a way to create astral machinery, in a way, or move astral machinery. The religion was started by a rubber tapper in the 1920s, and he took it with indigenous tribes and began to see the mother of the forest, or the Virgin Mary, and she gave him all these hymns to sing. And the hymns kind of call in these different spiritual presences. So you'll sing this hymn about the mother of the forest, and then you'll begin to perceive this kind of vast astral feminine being kind of twirling over your head, sort of blessing you and being with you during the ceremony. So I found it a very magical and very useful way of taking this medicine.
Some countries are using this on a pretty regular basis, but it is illegal here in the United States, right?
Well, there's some very complicated legal battles now going on. There's two main Brazilian religions, Santo Daime and Unão de Vegetalis. The American head is Jeffrey Bronfman, who's one of the heirs to the Seagram's family fortune.
Right.
And he's been bringing the tea in for years, but I guess it was seized a few years ago, and he's been in a long battle, he's actually won throughout the federal court system, and it may go to the Supreme Court. I'm not exactly sure of the status about it at the moment, to have the tea protected as the use of the sacrament in religious practices, much like peyote in the Native American church.
Can it hurt you? I mean, is there a possibility of...
It doesn't seem to have any possibility to hurt you. I mean, they did studies on the Brazilian religions when they were thinking about whether or not to kind of legalize it there, and they found that people in the religion were generally healthier, happier, you know, they didn't beat their wives, they had less psychological problems, so they gave it the green light.
Interesting. Indeed. You grind it from the plant?
Actually, when I was down in the Amazon, part of our sort of initiation process was we learned how to make it, which was really, really fun. It's two components. There's the leaves of a plant, Psychotria viridis, and this thick jungle vine, Banisteriopsis capi. And the leaves represent the feminine aspect, and the vine is the masculine aspect. And when you are working on the medicine, you sing and you also drink some of the ayahuasca. So you get into this highly attuned state where you really feel like the plant is actually teaching you how it wants to be worked with.
What's it taste like, Dave? Danny?
I got to like the taste. At first it seemed awful to me. And also it often makes people throw up the first times they take it. But in the end, you know, it always made me shudder a little bit. It's a little bitter. You know, it's definitely jungle, you know, stuff brewed together. It's really not so bad.
How quickly does it affect you?
You know, the one cup probably lasts like 3 or 4 hours. When you do these Daime cups, I guess it comes on in about an hour, they continue through the night. You may drink like 3 or 4 cups in a night. And they're also pretty much expert on dosages and some ceremonies. Like as we went deeper into the Amazon, the medicine got stronger and stronger.
Can you function, or do you have to just... lie down, you know, after you've taken this?
Well, you actually completely can function. I mean, some of these ceremonies that they do, people stand up and dance for 12 or 13 hours.
I mean, would you recommend you get in a car and drive around?
I definitely would not recommend driving around in a car.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, in terms of the ability to travel, let's say astrally, for example, after you've taken this, does it kind of release the consciousness a little bit better than someone who might not be using this?
Yeah, definitely. It loosens your consciousness like a loose tooth or something. Definitely. I mean, you are definitely given access to other realms. That's why it's, you know, it can, you know, it's really nice to do it in a ceremony where somebody has proper intention and is kind of sort of trying to bring the energy upwards and keep it centered. It's an incredible tool, and I definitely hope that Bronfman wins his case and that it becomes possible to do it here. I think it could be a very powerful medicine for kind of healing the sick Western condition.
Well, what other psychedelics are out there?
There's a huge number. I mean, as I wrote about in Breaking Open the Head, there's Sasha Shulgin, who is a scientist who spent like 30 or 40 years creating new psychedelic compounds and compiling them in these huge books. A lot of them are not even illegal. They're just sort of unknown. There's obviously LSD, the mushrooms, peyote, San Pedro, morning glory seeds. I mean, it's pretty astonishing how, you know, large a profusion of the botanical world wants to work with us in this way. You know?
Does the animal world use these? I mean, that is a bizarre question, but I mean, if it's out there in the wild, mm-hmm. I'm wondering if animals, you know, touch these too.
I think they do. I think there's an Italian researcher, Giorgio Samarini, who's done some work on that subject, but it's not something that particularly interested me, so I didn't really look into it.
All right, let's go to some fast blasts here and ask you a question or two. Let's see. Oh, here's some people are saying the Hopi are in Arizona, not New Mexico.
Yeah, that's probably right. I have terrible geography.
Ah, okay. All right. LSD, that's a psychedelic. During the 70s, of course, we were all told that stuff will kill you. You do not believe that. Tell me about it.
Right. When LSD was first discovered and sort of used in the 50s and early 60s, it was actually considered a wonder drug. It was considered astonishingly safe. And it was being used in all these different therapeutic ways to treat alcoholics and so on. It was only when the genie got out of the bottle and mass consumption started that, I think with psychedelics, since they're mind manifesting chemicals and mind amplifiers, how we construct our discourse around them and how language is used around them actually really affects even what happens to people when they take these trips. So when mainstream magazines began to report that these were going to drive you insane and make you kill yourself and so on, that also started happening. Definitely LSD can be incredibly potent, and we know that from the 60s, and it should, actually there's no legal way to use it whatsoever pretty much at this point.
Remember the CIA? CIA gave it to somebody who jumped out of a window or something like that? I don't know
if
you remember
that. Or was pushed out of a window.
Pushed.
I mean, that's a whole complicated story.
Or bumped out of a window?
I mean, I actually think, one thing I keep thinking about is the origin of LSD is so fascinating. It was discovered in 1938 by this Sandoz chemist, Albert Hofmann, and didn't seem to do anything. They were synthesizing ergot fungus, and he shelved it. And then 5 years later, in Basel, in the middle of the Second World War, he began to have dreams about the molecular structure of LSD, and it was the first time he'd ever gone back and resynthesized something that hadn't shown any ability. And then somehow he got some on his hands or swallowed a little bit and had the first unintentional LSD trip. And that was 1943. It was, to me, there's an interesting kind of almost like archetypal, newospheric kind of moment here where if you think about Europe at that point with the Nazis and the Final Solution on the Holocaust, and then Albert Hofmann kind of opens the gates on this other tool for consciousness right in the middle of that whole thing. And actually the first intentional LSD trip that he took was the day that the Nazis invaded the Warsaw Ghetto to shut it down. I don't know, it's just, for me, that has a lot of resonance.
If you're not going to use these for tools to reach your consciousness and to let it do what it's supposed to do, do you recommend people even trying that then?
I don't really recommend anything with psychedelics. I don't think it's really my place. I mean, it's such an individual decision, and obviously the legal structure is completely against it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Next up, Hadron from Connecticut wants to know, how did you get initiated into shamanic practice? How did that all come about?
Yeah, well, basically, I write about this in Breaking Open the Head. I went through a massive spiritual crisis where I couldn't see the point to my New York cynical lifestyle. And then I sort of went back into my past and tried to figure out where I had any kind of access to other experiences of consciousness, other dimensions. And I remembered psychedelic experiences from college. So then I started to get some magazine assignments. And, probably the one that sort of put me over the edge was going down to West Africa, to Gabon, with a botanist and going through an initiation ceremony there where my whole past was kind of revealed to me in a different way. And after that, I went for another magazine down to the Amazon in Ecuador. So that was really my entry was journalistic.
Have any of the shamans or the people you've talked to, Daniel, have they talked about the soul in anything?
Oh, yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, on many levels. I mean, there's soul loss, soul retrieval. I mean, these are shamanic practices. You know, the idea is that, as we go through our life sort of pattern, when we have crises or cataclysms or, it could be magical attack, I guess, also, sometimes a little piece of our soul gets kind of trapped or left behind. So shamans can become experts at retrieving the soul, kind of weaving it back into a whole. Helping us to unify.
Somewhat controversial, but James Arthur, a past guest on Coast to Coast, believes that the mushroom was basically representing Jesus and Santa Claus. You've heard that?
Well, definitely Santa Claus. I don't think there's any doubt. I mean, that's pretty obvious because the red and white capped mushroom, the Siberian shamans, which was loved by the reindeer who would come from miles around, and that was their... that mushroom would dispense gifts from the other world to the shamans. So that seems to be pretty clear. The Jesus one is a little more complicated. I mean, there was a famous book by John Allegro, which was massively criticized, I think ruined his career, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. But there definitely were, frescoes, indications there was a mushroom cult in early Christianity sort of related to Gnosticism. You know, I don't know if that goes back directly to Christ. I mean, there's a lot of stuff sort of circulating about that he also wrote, that he also ate bread that was infected with mad rye, which was also a form of ergot, which is close to LSD. If you talk to the UDV, the United Vegetalists, this ayahuasca religion, they think there's a sort of ayahuasca-based aspect to the Temple of Solomon, and, you know, so it gets all contrived and complex. You know, we only know what we know.
I wonder how the shamans even stumbled across things like ayahuasca. I mean, who would even think about that?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, because ayahuasca involves brewing together these two plants that don't seem to have any connection to each other in a very specific way. And, you know, obviously there are millions of plants in the jungle. But if you ask the shamans, they just say that the vine told them how to do it and told them what to do, you know. And I pretty much imagine that's the case, that, you know, they were in some trance state or just sleeping. And just as Albert Hofmann received the, you know, the kind of molecular message from LSD, I'm sure the shamans receive the message from the plants as to what to do.
Tell us a little bit more about that prophetic transmission you got while you were in Brazil.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, basically, during one of these Santo Daime ceremonies, and I went to Brasilia, and I was incredibly miserable in the Santo Daime ceremonies at first, because they were so religious. It was very hard for me to get around to it. And eventually, I kind of learned to surrender to it, and then I actually learned to love the music and realized there was something really important going on. But during the Santo Daime ritual, where I was hating the whole experience, and I went outside, I was walking around, and I was thinking that I was back in the ceremony, I was just thinking about the Mayans, and I had all these kind of strange, synchronistic experiences. Like, for instance, with Jose Arguelles, when I contacted him, he mapped me into his calendar system, and it turned out that we were perfect helping partners. He's a blue spectral monkey, and I'm a yellow spectral star. And also, my birthday, June 15th, was the day, June 15th, 1953, I guess it was, when they opened the tomb of Pakalvotan, which for him was key to this whole discovery of this time code. So there was that. And then also, when I was in England studying the crop circles, one day, the first time I went into Stonehenge, which had various levels of resonance to me, I also had this thinking about my name. Pinchbeck is my last name, and it's actually an English word. One of my ancestors was a kind of alchemist, and he invented a kind of false gold, which became Pinchbeck gold. And the name Anything also came to mean anything false or spurious. And it suddenly occurred to me that was a very strange synonym for the concept of Maya, which means kind of world of illusion or a kind of false world. And it suddenly dawned on me that I was somehow knitted into this whole narrative that I thought I was more or less journalistically investigating. And then when I was down in Brazil, I basically started to receive a transmission of a prophecy related to the return of Quetzalcoatl, which then took a week or so to sort of fully download and write out, and that'll be part of my book.
Some have believed that Quetzalcoatl is also Jesus. Do you believe that at all?
Well, I don't think he's also Jesus. I mean, I suppose on some higher level, I mean, you know, there's this kind of idea there's ultimately a kind of unitary consciousness. But I mean, just as there's a differentiation between, you know, Buddha and Jesus, I would think there's also differentiation between Buddha, Jesus, and Quetzalcoatl. It's kind of different manifestations of, you know, consciousness or divine consciousness or some access to the sacred. I mean, my understanding of Quetzalcoatl is really that it was a kind of vibrational level of consciousness, and it was the level we would reach when we were integrating the Eastern spiritual traditions with all of that, which is, you know, a highly elaborate system of thought, including reincarnation and so on, with our Western scientific, technical knowledge. And that's when we will reintegrate and create heaven and earth. You know,
Gene from Houston wants to know if crop formations and circles might not be messages for people on this planet, but messages for other extraterrestrials passing through Earth. That's interesting.
It's possible. I don't know what to say about that.
Okay. Let's go on to a few others here. John from Wichita says, look, I used to take LSD. It's bad. I used to take it during high school. It's been 15 years since I touched the stuff, and I would not wish the bad effects on anyone. What are the bad effects for, let's say, LSD?
Well, I mean, anything, I mean, I think, you know, we have this big problem in our culture that also obviously became clear in the 60s, too, that it's a very consumer-based culture, and people aren't given good direction. I mean, the government just says, don't take this stuff, you know, and doesn't give anyone any help. I mean, there's no support structure for having these experiences. And especially for young people, you know, I think it's a natural inclination to alter consciousness. I mean, I think it's basic, fundamental to human beings. Andrew Weil pointed that out really, really well. So they're in this culture that frowns on, you know, any altered states. So then they start grabbing for what's around them, and they overuse it. And definitely LSD is a very potent mind amplifier and can open you into all these different levels of consciousness that you just may not be ready to explore or to integrate. You know, I mean, this is why Timothy Leary in the 60s had the idea that there should be professional therapeutic class that would be sort of like a therapeutic shamanic class that would work with people in altered states. And I think that once we come to our senses about this material, that's what we'll do. And I think that these agents, these substances, these medicines can be profound deconditioning agents to help reformat kind of our society.
And you do not consider cocaine or heroin psychedelics, right?
Definitely not.
Okay.
I mean, they definitely have powerful spirits attached to them, but I think they're very, very negative spirits.
I think you're right about that, too. Daniel, what do you recommend for people who go to your website? What are some of the things they should look for?
Well, the fun thing on the website is the discussion board, which has been an ongoing, fabulous sort of discourse by numerous voices on all of these subjects. And I've definitely learned like a huge amount from the people who've come through there.
Yeah, me too. Same thing for me. I mean, some of the feedback you get, very important, I think, for change and development. You're probably getting the same thing. You know?
Definitely.
All right, well, stay with us. We're going to open up the phone lines next hour with our guest, Daniel Pinchbeck. And you know the numbers, but if you don't, we'll give them to you in just a moment as well. If you need to email me ever, it's george@coast2am.com with our guest tonight, Daniel Pinchbeck. His website, breakingopenthehead.com, linked up with his name right now on Coast to Coast. His most current book is called Breaking Open the Head, A Psychedelic Journey into the Heart of Contemporary Shamanism. And then next year, around this time, he'll have another book out. And we'll probably have him back when the book's out. Back in a moment.
I've just closed my eyes again. Climbed aboard the Dreamweaver train.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.